Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. My name is Michelle Zeman, and I am your host. And I am super excited about today's guest and today's topic. Oh, my goodness. We're going to be diving into a lot of really heavy stuff, but at the same time, I think it's stuff that really just needs to be disseminated as an entirety. So today I have BCBA Victoria Contreras on the podcast with me. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you. I'm honestly really excited to be diving into this conversation and just really being able to share my experience. So this is really awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I definitely, when we talked, you know, a few weeks ago, you told me so much and it just opened my eyes to, you know, just how much our field needs to continue to change, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it. So what first drew you to ABA and what were your hopes when you first started out in the field?
So to be honest, I had no idea what ABA was. I was going to school for social work at the time and a friend recommended, he had interviewed at an ABA clinic nearby and he had interviewed and he was like, hey, I think that you would really like this job. So I was like, okay, why not? I had no idea what I really wanted to do at that point. And so I went into the interview and I remember at one point, the owner asked me what autism was, and I didn't have an answer. I didn't have an answer of what autism was. I had been around autistic people my entire life, and I understood it, but I couldn't tell her what autism was, and that really stood out to me. I ended up working at that clinic for about 10 months. I transferred schools because of it once I fell in love with ABA, but I remember just one behavioral child that we had, and afterwards, I gave him some cool down time and he was just playing with his toys and he made this intense Ferris wheel. Like it was like spinning with he would spin it and it would just go and he was just stemming off of it. And it was just really cool to see. And for something about that, it resonated with me. I was like, this child is brilliant. And everyone would see this child as something negative because of the behavior he just had. And it'd be like, wow, like everything. But I just didn't see that. And I was like, I want to be a part of this, whatever that means. I want to be a part of it. And so I didn't turn back. I transferred schools, I minored in ABA, and I knew that that's what I wanted to do at that point.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, it's so interesting because we look at the people that we work with and we might see, oh, well, this child or this person engages in all these different behaviors, but why don't we see the good side? Why don't we see the fact that, hey, this really cool kid made this really awesome Ferris wheel? That's something that not a lot of neurotypical people could even say.
Yeah. Especially to be at that level of emotion. And he's like, nope, this is how I'm calming down. This is what makes me happy. And it's just awesome to see how the brain works in that sense of just someone so incredible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and again, everyone has their own coping skills. And so it's really important to not just teach you need to breathe in and breathe out. Oh, you need to take a few laps. No, if this is what helps you cope, then this is what helps you cope, and we need to respect that.
It's not just a preferred item that you don't get to have right now because you just engage in this behavior. This is probably their safe space.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I still remember at one of my first ABA jobs, I was actually giving one of my kids some Play-Doh because it actually helped him calm down because he would squeeze it. But then I was told, oh, well, you're reinforcing the behavior by giving him what he wants. And it's like, he's squeezing Play-Doh to breathe, and you're impacting this for the negative for him. And that's not cool. Not cool.
Yeah. I always think about the long term of if this is something super positive to them, we don't want to relate negative emotions that they're feeling with their favorite things. That's just not going to benefit anyone.
Right. Exactly. And if, you know, our science is supposed to be all about changing behavior, we need to actually respect, you know, the things that our clients need to do to be able to cope, whether that be, you know, taking deep breaths like some of our children do, or if they want to build a Ferris wheel, or if they want to, you know, talk about Pokemon or whatever that may be, whatever that looks like. Everybody is different.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about some of the early challenges you faced within your career. I think we talked a little bit about it was in your second position in ABA.
So at this time, I was minoring in ABA, so I was getting my hours. So I got to see a little bit more of the backside of the programming and everything. One thing that I will always remember is we had a five-year-old who loved being social. He was that giddy, happy child. He was just all over the place. And so I just remember him being so incredibly happy, but he was learning really difficult things like tying a shoe and doing zippers and Velcros, and kids with dexterity issues, like, this is a very difficult task. And we had a color chart, and if he started crying or anything during his table time, we were supposed to remove it, and each color removed his highest reinforcers, essentially. And I got to a point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. And so when we sat down for table time, I said, hey, bud, if this is really difficult, we can ask for a break or we can ask for help and I will always help you. And that's how I ran my sessions. And afterwards, I would have therapists arguing with me because they were upset of the way that I ran my sessions and that they were having these super big behaviors because they were following that protocol. And I was like, I get it. But at the same time, I will not punish a child for his emotions when he is doing something hard. Like, everything in my body is telling me that I can't do this, so I can't. And they were arguing me about this because they were having these intense behaviors. And I was like, then tell him you can help him. Like, we expect him to learn, but we're not showing him how. And then he's frustrated and he's punished for that. Like, I just didn't see in what world that made sense. And so that was a really big one. We had a kid that we had severe script, not even severe, intense scripting. Like, this girl, it was the most applicable thing ever. She watched shows, she learned how to communicate with it, and it was so, so applicable, but it was all from her favorite cartoons, and it was incredible. And at one point, we just randomly started implementing RIRD. And it led to very severe SIB. She was headbanging on the floors, on the walls, and everything, but we didn't have any data from anything before. We didn't know the function. We didn't know any really real replacement behaviors. It just led to this intense thing. And I remember we were trying to question things because at the time we were students. And so we were like, why did we do this at this point? Because, like, we don't have the previous data. We don't have any information about this behavior. And it was just kind of like, we were told not to ask questions about programming. We're here to look at data on the systems, but we're not here to make decisions. And so I was like, okay. Like, it just kind of was that. I remember getting a review and it was, I wasn't willing to be accepting of things and that I just needed to, like, look at things in a different way and it didn't always have to kind of be my way. And I was like, okay, like, whatever. And so then this all was happening, but then on the other side of things, there was a lot of racial things going on. It was a family that we had that the dad had big, beautiful, curly hair. And at one point, all of the boys in their family cut their hair. And our supervisor came in the room and she was like, did you guys see so-and-so's dad? Like, he cut his hair and it looks so much like less raggedy, more professional. And I'm sitting here with my curly hair and the other girl in the room has curly hair. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And I remember having the conversation with her that, like, this wasn't okay. And she's like, well, that's not what I meant. And I was like, but you said it. And so it was just very uncomfortable all the time. It was a comment made about a child not smelling the way that they expected. And, well, Black people do have a scent. And it was just accepted. Like, no one said anything. Like, it was just, yeah, this is just how it is. And it just, nothing ever sat right with me. I tried having a conversation with my supervisor. You could tell it wasn't receptive at all. I went to our clinical director and she sent out a message in the chat of being mindful of what you say around kids. And I was like, And at the time I was getting my degree in sociology with a concentration in race and gender. So everything about this, and I'm like, no one questions anything going on in this building. And so I finally got another job and I quit. I was like, I can't do this anymore. My kids were on their way out. My favorite child that he was getting punished all the time. He was going to preschool or kindergarten in a couple weeks. So I was like, he's good. Like, he's out of here. I essentially felt like his little protector. Like, I was the one sitting there fighting for this guy and he was leaving. And I was like, you're out of it, dude. I'm out too.
Oh my God. So I know that this is an audio podcast, but I just want to give you guys an idea of what my faces were like throughout that entire thing. I went from being mad to being like, what the actual, to are you actually serious right now? Because this just goes to show you that there are some people out there that do not understand a lot of different things. First of all, I'm going to go back to that first example you said about the child who, you know, you were teaching him how to ask for help and how to ask for a break. That's what we should be doing in the first place, not trying to pull this whole, like, you have to do it. And if you cry, God forbid, you shed a tear.
Your five-year-old child shows an emotion.
Oh my God, how dare you show any emotions? They're 5 years old. They are 5 years old, and they're not allowed to show an emotion. Are we trying to make our kids like robots? Are we trying? Because that's not okay. Like, I think I would have struggled in that same exact protocol because, again, like, why? What's the point of trying to call out a kid's behavior when they're crying when you have skills that most five-year-olds, neurotypical too, by the way, do not know how to do? Like,
kids are wearing Velcro straps in kindergarten. Like, it's normal.
Yeah, that's developmentally appropriate. I didn't learn how to tie my shoes until I was 7, because when I tried to do it back then, I had a lot of issues with just trying to figure out where the laces need to go and what to do. And it's like the fact that, number one, this was taught to a five-year-old, which, you know, if you want to teach certain skills to, you know, kids, that's all great and dandy. But when you're not teaching them and you're punishing them for, you know, having big emotions around things that are extremely complicated, you know, this, you said that this kid had dexterity issues. If I had dexterity issues and I had the same thing with the shoe tying, I would absolutely be having, you know, absolutely, moments of crying and having moments of, like, you know, frustration.
Especially when the trusted adult in front of you is punishing for you for how you feel in that moment. Like, exactly. I just remember thinking of the correlation of emotions and doing things that are hard. It's just like, that is teaching a child to be so shameful of how they feel.
Exactly. Exactly. So now we can't have big emotions. Now we can't even have emotions other than happy. We can't teach our kids to ask for help, which, by the way, is an appropriate functional replacement behavior. Hello. Asking for a break when something is hard. Again, another functional replacement behavior. You know, like, no wonder the kid had big tantrums, because they weren't actually, like, listening to the kid and respecting the kid. Goes back to client dignity.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. And then the second client you were talking about with the intense scripting and then going into the SIB. I mean, again, why? Like, why?
That was such a learning moment for me, though, because that was probably one of the first times where I fully was able to recognize what's stemming, how it supports kids. Yeah. And that I was like, if you take that away, it's going to go somewhere else. And I always think of that. It's either going to go into something, the replacement skill that we're teaching, or it's going to go into something negative that this child can't communicate to us. And so often it does end up to SIB, and that we're creating that behavior in them.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and if the scripting isn't impeding their ability to live their best life, if it's not self-injurious or harmful to themselves or other around them, why are we replacing this behavior?
There's absolutely no reason.
Like, you're just giving them an RIRD just because you want to do an RIRD. That to me, like, the fact that someone would even think, oh, let's replace this behavior that has absolutely no impact on anybody else, and I don't know what their learning style was like, but if it has no impact on anybody else, but now we're going to go, now we have this really huge behavior that is, like, that is impacting their safety, their health, everything around them. You've abused the child. That's the way that I abuse that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's just, and then again, like, you know, going back to the comments you were saying about the child's dad whose hair got cut, and then the son's got their hair cut too. Think before you talk. I mean, come on. That's just common sense here.
It was also incredibly baffling that no one batted their eyes at that. Like, it was just like, we're carrying on. Like, no one saw anything wrong with it. And that truly was mind-blowing to me. It still is.
Yeah. How long ago was this again?
I left this company in 2021. So it was from October 2022 to June 2021.
Wow. Yeah. The fact that it happened so long ago, and there are people still today who make these types of comments. You know, we're supposed to be more culturally responsive. We're supposed to be competent. We're supposed to be trauma informed. And, you know, we're supposed to lead with, you know, assent and everything. And it's like, we're completely doing things backwards. And for what?
There's just in no world where I would see one of my clients' parents and think to come back and comment on something about their looks. Like, it Like sometimes we'll be like, wow, that mom's had a rough day. Like you can just tell she's exhausted or like things like that. It is never their hair today. Crazy. Like it's just never about anything about their looks. And so it's just so baffling to think that.
Yeah. Like imagine if that was somebody saying that about you, like you would feel pretty awful too, you know?
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. I cannot, you know, that being said, how did it feel to constantly be in that position where you just, you really had to call out harmful behavior for what it was, especially as you were starting out?
Calling people out on their behavior was not new to me. I have always been an incredibly strong-willed, like, my beliefs are my beliefs, and if someone doesn't like me because of it, that's their problem, not my problem kind of person. And so it wasn't new to me to be calling out these things. It was me more so trying to be thoughtful in how I called it out, because yeah. I can be reactionary in that sense. And so I had to make sure that I was covering my bases, especially knowing the harm that everything could be doing. And so it wasn't uncomfortable. It was just more being strategic for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially like when you have these very harmful things that are happening before your eyes, I can imagine it has to be really hard to like hold it together. At least I don't know about you. I'm not really a confrontational type of person. And so for me, it's like trying to call things out has gotten easier. But I remember in the very beginning, it was one of the hardest things to do. So I can only imagine.
Especially being new in the field, it was almost like I felt that how I saw things or how I felt about things didn't matter because I might not have actually known what was going on. And so that was what I told myself a lot of times until finally I was like, no, this is not right. No matter what I know or anything right now, like this is not right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and again, it's just, it's so wild to me that, you know, these types of behaviors were acceptable in the clinic and no one batted their eyes at these types of behaviors. No one ever like thought, hey, maybe I need to change my own behavior before changing other people's behavior.
Yeah, that's always something I truly think about when I'm doing this, especially when it comes to like when people talk about the power fight. I'll be in the middle of something and I'm like, do I need you to do this? Or is it because I want you to do this? And I'll completely change the shift on how I'm approaching something if I realize that there's no reason why this child shouldn't need to do this or want to do this right now. Like it's their time. Of course, we can let them play with whatever, do whatever. And so that's something I try to communicate and teach all the time is that is it because they need to, like there's the things of brushing our teeth, eating, like the all of the caretaking things, but does this child really need to go right now because I need them to? Like, do we really need to fight those things?
Exactly. You know, at the end of the day, if it's not impacting their health and safety, then why are we trying to fight this power struggle? You know, I've seen it where it's like, you know, you have to follow through with a demand in place. And if you followed through with a demand in place, you won the battle. But at the same time, it's like, wait a minute, I just caused harm inadvertently. And I remember personally having issues where it was like, there was a girl that I remember, we had to do an escape extinction protocol. I was a BT at the time. And she had to say one word. And it was like, why am I doing this? And no one was teaching me ways to actually like get her to say the word. Like no one was teaching me, hey, she should ask for a break. Hey, she should be asking for help. And I didn't know that at the time. You know, none of my supervisors even thought of that too. They just said, you have to follow through with the demand in place no matter what. And that like absolutely disgusts me as a BCBA.
And
you
it's
know?
So hard to unlearn. It is truly so, once it's ingrained in you, it is so hard to unlearn and actively fight that, especially at the beginning. Like once you get it, you get it. But it's at the beginning, it is so hard to unlearn that and catch yourself in the moment and be able to identify that.
It really, really is. It's awful. I know one thing that we talked a little bit about before too is CPI or crisis prevention intervention. And you're telling me about having to do CPI in public places. Tell us a little bit more about that and also how those situations shaped your view on what ABA should not be.
Absolutely. So the very first clinic I worked at, we did a lot of things in the community. So we would go on field trips, especially over the summer, we would go on field trips, and we were by the beach. So we would take the kids to the beach. We would take them to the Children's Museum, skating rinks. Like, we did all sorts of things. But I remember one time we went to the beach and a larger child went into behavior, and three or four of the therapists just immediately go in and are trying to perform CPR on the child. And all of us are having to stand by and stand with all of these other kids that we have with us. And it was in the beach parking lot, just out in the open
for everyone to see,
with no parents around. Like, it was, there wasn't anything, like, it was literally just the therapist and all of these kids with us.
Oh my God.
And I'm pretty sure I want to say that we didn't even have a BCBA with us. It was probably just our lead therapist at this clinic. In 10 months, I didn't know supervision was a thing. So, like, I remember them kind of, like, being around, but they weren't sitting with us. They weren't sitting there giving us feedback unless a behavior was happening. And that was really kind of it. But from all of that, my main go-to rule now is if I feel anywhere close to inside, before, during, or after the way I felt back then when I was seeing these things, I shouldn't be doing it. If what I'm doing makes me feel gross, I'm not doing it. And it's just that feeling that you know and you just don't want to be a part of. And so that's been really helpful for me to kind of follow as my guideline.
That's huge. And, you know, it's already bad enough that, you know, like, what we do, we get a lot of flack for what we do because, you know, ABA does not have the greatest history. But that being said, you know, let's just add more to the stigma and do CPI out in public where people can see us, you know. And again, like, let's add more stigma. Like, that's baffling to me.
I just can't imagine as a parent learning that that happened to my child that day and not thinking that anything was wrong with that.
Right. That's what I would want to know. Like, where are the parents? Where are, you know, where's the supervisors? Which, I mean, that's a whole other conversation, which, you know, you mentioned something that really stood out to me is you didn't even know supervision wasn't a thing. I remember barely being supervised when I was first starting out too. And, you know, they would come in for like 30 minutes or an hour, and then they would just like walk out, and, you know, I would get some feedback here, some feedback there, but it's like, we're the ones pretty much running the show at this point.
One feedback I specifically remember at this clinic, though, was we had a 7-year-old that would go into behavior at school about getting in line. No child likes being at the back of the line. That's just what it is. But yeah, he would go into behaviors, but he didn't do them at the clinic. And I remember them being like, well, push it until he does. We need to be able to see this. And I was like, you want me to force this child to go into behavior so that we can fix the behavior that he wasn't engaging in?
What? Like, let's just contrive behavior just for the hell of it? Like, I don't, wow. I don't understand these practices that some BCBAs, I know this was back a few years ago, but even today, this is still happening.
And that's the sad part, is people learned from these things. Like, they were teaching people all of this. And so it is so difficult to think that. I remember the BCBAs would go in the mornings, but by the time our afternoon session started about 2:33, they were gone. So we didn't have BCBAs. We had our office manager and maybe a lead BCBA or a lead RBT. And that was who was there to support us.
That's so wild, you know, and it just goes to show you how different things are today. And granted, different does not always mean better. But, you know, I know personally, if there was not a BCBA on site anywhere, like whether that be, you know, at our clinic or online or something, that's a bad sign, you know. And the fact that you were at this company where they only had a lead RBT after 2:30, it's not like you can just turn off life at 2 o'clock or 12 o'clock or whatever time you sign out. No, this is your child's lives, and you're just
responsible.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds like those supervisors need to be reported to the board, quite frankly, if I can be honest here.
Absolutely. I Back then, I just remember I did my 40-hour training before I even started working there. I worked as a BT for probably over 6 out of the 10 months that I worked there without taking my RBT certification. Like it was, they just wanted someone there. And when I started, I was making $10 an hour.
Yeah.
So
Wow.
it was baffling to know that this space, it's no longer open, which is incredible, but.
Oh my God. I just cannot because again, it's like, how is this happening? Why is this happening? You're not even being properly like supervised, you're not being properly trained. The fact that you didn't know supervision wasn't a thing until, in like,
Years later.
yeah, I mean, come on. BCBAs, please do better. Please do better.
That's what we're here for.
Exactly. Thank God we're BCBAs now, right? Oh my goodness. Well, when you eventually did put in your 2 weeks, what pushed you? What was the final straw?
Knowing my kids were leaving soon was a big part of it, of the just the time frame. I did get another job that I felt really safe at. I cried during my interview when we were having the conversations that we were having, just learning that a supervisor felt the way that I felt, and it wasn't the end of the road in that sense, that I was going to keep going to other places and everyone was going to have this viewpoint, because that was a big fear for me. So finding a place that I felt safe, and realizing that it was still something that I loved and that wasn't where I wanted to learn from. And so knowing that I had to go somewhere else if I wanted to learn anything different.
Absolutely. And I remember we talked a little bit about how one job they were trying to push you to sign an NDA. Tell us a little bit about that.
So it was the company that all of the racial things happened, that we were doing really awful interventions. And so when I put in my 2 weeks, the office manager called me into her office and was kind of like, "What's up?" Because it was probably a shock that I was leaving. And so I told her everything. Like it was probably a 45-minute meeting where I told her everything. And she s made it seem like it was as awful as that what it was, and she made it seem that something was going to happen. And so that's kind of how I felt leaving that situation. I had put in the 2 weeks, so then she was going to be gone my last day. So a few days before, she called me into her office and just said we needed to sign all final paperwork. Nothing else, we just needed to sign final paperwork. And she had me kind of sign some like final papers, and then she said, "Okay, you just need to sign this so we can release your PTO." And she slid it over to me. And so I'm like, "Okay, cool." And so I'm reading it. And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, this is an NDA." And I couldn't tell. I was 20 years old. I didn't know what an NDA actually was, but I knew that that was an NDA. And so I
Yeah.
was like, "I'm not signing this." And I just made that quick decision and I wrote not applicable on the line. So I made it seem like I was signing it and I slid it back over. And she's like, "Okay, cool. So Friday's your last day, like everything." And then she looks down and she reads it. And she was like, "So you're not signing this?" And I was like, "No, I don't feel comfortable at this time signing that." And she was like, "Okay, well, just to let you know, you won't be getting paid out your PTO." I said, "Keep it. That. Keep it." And that was that conversation. She went out of town and I never saw her again. So
Wow. Now, didn't you try to pursue legal action after that too?
I, because of everything that happened, it's the care that we were giving. When I was at the clinic, we reported them to CPS. Like we went all the way at different times. And so I went about that. I went about the racial discrimination and everything, but I just didn't have enough. And so I live in Texas. Texas workplace protection laws are incredibly awful. If anyone knows, you know. And so it was kind of a dead wall. I realized that I didn't have anything. I talked to a couple different like nonprofit orgs and everything that supported workplace law, but there was just not enough. I didn't have proper documentation. I didn't have proof of a lot of things that were happening. So it was just didn't seem like enough. And I remember going to like the board website, but they want proof for different things. And it was just, and unfortunately, this company does have people in place to prevent them being reported to the board that are running these clinics. And so it made it very hard to hold people accountable in that situation.
That's ridiculous. Oh my gosh. And again, it just goes to show you, like, that permanent product really, really does matter. Like, save your email, save your text messages, save it all, because you never know if for some reason, you know, something does happen. You need to have that backup. You need to have that evidence in case someone tries to incriminate you wrongfully.
Then send the follow-up emails, please.
Yeah. Send them once, send them twice, you know, keep sending them, annoy the shit out of them. I don't like to curse, but very often, especially now on the podcast, but it's needed in this situation, just because it's like, you know, the fact that they feel like they need to have these like protections, and, you know, the fact that they were trying to give you an NDA, for those of you who don't know, is a non-disclosure agreement. And basically it prevents you from being able to talk about your experiences. The fact that someone was trying to do that to you, I mean, is just, first of all, thank God they're illegal, but still, it's just insane. It's insane to me.
I never would have imagined that would have been the situation that I was walking out from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And was it at that point that you had stepped away from ABA for a little bit?
I worked at one company after that. It was a company that was coming out to Texas. I was the first RBT in the state of Texas with them. I had a really, really amazing supervisor at the time. She was incredible. She is a lot of where I take from what I do now as a BCBA. But we were in home and we were building in a community that is overly saturated by other companies. And so it was really, really difficult to keep and maintain clients. At one point I was working 7 hours a week and that was all we had on the schedule. And so it was really hard to keep working in that environment. At that point though, I had some incredible families and I was happy to leave at that point and step away from direct care just because I did have such a positive experience, and it was just the logistics that didn't make that work out.
Yeah, that's always sad, you know, and unfortunately that's a very real situation, being oversaturated with other companies that want to come in and, you know, have clients for their own, but then also at the same time, you're trying to build your own schedule, your own caseload, and it's like, there's no way to do this feasibly.
Not at all. And at the time I was still, when I left the company that tried to get me assigned an NDA, I lost all of my BCABA hours. And so I just kind of took the L and moved on and was going to start everything else out. But once I was only working 7 hours per week, I was like, okay, well, this still isn't feasible to try and get the certification and do everything. And so it just felt like the right time to step away. I was incredibly burnt out at that point and it just felt right then.
Absolutely. What did you do during the time that you stepped away?
I recruited. So I recruited for an ABA company. I recruited RBTs. That kind of ignited the fire a little bit more. At the time, I was speaking about what I loved about ABA from a more healed standpoint. And so it felt nice to tell people why I'm still here, why I'm still engaging in the field of ABA and everything. It was cool to for that to be people's first introduction to ABA was me telling the positives of it. And so it just felt good at that point, but it was also me having the conversations with my supervisor when my numbers were way lower than everyone else's, because we had these strict set of requirements and if they met all of them, we could hire them. And so I was often like, well, I'm not just hiring anyone to go into these families' homes to work with their children. I was very, very specific. If you said one wrong little phrase about how you spoke about a child, like an autistic child or anything, like, I was very, very weary about doing those things. And so my numbers at the beginning were probably 20 people lower than everyone else's, because I just did not feel comfortable just hiring anybody. And so I was still kind of expressing those beliefs in a different way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it just kind of goes to show you that, like, when it comes to hiring practices, we need to do better there too, because we shouldn't just be hiring a body to have a body with a family, you know.
There's some things you can't learn, and that's okay. There's some things you can't learn, and that's okay. But patience, you can get better at patience, but if you don't have it, this is not the place for you to be working. And just little things like that it's detrimental to who these children are exposed to. And if they don't have their best interest or understanding at that point, maybe it's not the best thing. And I always hear that especially engaging in certain conversations is, well, that's all the requirement is. They just have to go to high school. They have to pass this test in 40 hours and they're there. And they're the ones working directly with the kid. And so I just kept in mind of how easy it was to become an RBT.
Yeah. And I know that the sad thing is a lot of these families are waiting, you know, so many months, so many years even to get services. But then we have this person, let's just say like you were back in your recruiting position, you had hired everybody that came on, but you're just hiring a body. And that's what it is.
I just want a bonus.
Yeah. It's like, if that's your MO, then again, like this is not the feel because you're just literally hiring a body to have somebody there.
I had people interviewing, and there's nothing wrong with other jobs, but I had people interviewing that their jobs were like refrigerator technicians, but our job popped up when they job searched because it said registered behavior technician. So they applied and they're interviewing. And I'm just kind of like, if you don't even know what you're interviewing for, I probably can't hire you.
Right. Exactly. I've been in those types of positions too. And I've actually like, I remember actually interviewing a few people and, you know, nothing wrong with having outside ABA experience at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. But when I see someone who's working at Taco Bell and I'm asking them about ABA and I'm asking them about what it's, what their experience working with children with autism or different types of disabilities is like, and I'm saying no, but my boss is saying, no, you need to hire them. And it's like, why?
In 2 weeks, they're going to be on the floor working with our kids.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
That is very scary. And it's not just like scary from that standpoint, but, you know, we're talking about impacting lives here. This isn't like a fast food restaurant where we can go make a taco and call it a day. No.
We can teach them a recipe.
Exactly. Exactly. You can teach a recipe, but you can't teach how to necessarily like put love into a child the way that an RBT should put love into their child, the way that a BCBA, BCABA, whoever, if you're working in a customer service type of position like this, where you are changing lives, it doesn't take just a random body to get there.
Not at all.
Oh my goodness. Well, I want to go ahead and drop our first code word of the episode. And that code word is the word authentic. Authentic is A-U-T-H-E-N-T-I-C. That is the word authentic. Now, kind of going into, you know, we talked about like hiring random bodies and, you know, them coming into homes. Something that we see a lot online is the anti-ABA conversations. And, you know, I know that some of it comes from bad BCBA practices. Some of it comes from bad implementation from techs. Some of it is everything in between. How did engaging with those conversations online shape your reflection during that time?
A lot of us are familiar with the conversations that are being gone. To say that you're not is to willfully be choosing to be ignorant. And so a lot of times when I was joining these Facebook groups or watching these interviews or these videos, I never came from it as a defensive space. I wanted to hear those experiences. I wanted to hear what people had done wrong and to know everything. And I feel like a lot of people do join the conversations and they're getting defensive behind the keyboard of this is what ABA isn't and everything. And it's we need to be listening. And so when I was seeing all of these things, a lot of times it was, don't do ABA, but there's no other alternative. Sometimes OT works, and it's not anything negative about OT. It just doesn't work for everyone. Just as ABA doesn't work for everyone. And so it was OT doesn't work. I've tried OT, I've tried play therapy, and just nothing is there. But there was no other alternative to ABA that was provided that was accessible to anyone. And unfortunately, ABA is the only full therapy that is covered by insurance a lot of the time that gives you enough hours. And so I realized that if I wanted to be a part of the change, it was going to have to be on the inside. If I wanted to keep affecting lives the way that I wanted to, I was going to have to do ABA, but do it in a way that mattered to me and to the families that I was serving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's so interesting too, because, you know, like we see these conversations and I see a lot of people being like, well, that's not today's ABA. And it's like, how about this? Right. You know, I try to like just look at the conversations. I don't necessarily try to insert myself into the conversation. I just look at the conversation and I go, okay, I need to do better. Because the thing is, we're working with people's lives and we're working on changing behaviors that could impact their lives for the better. That's the goal, is for the better, you know, whether that be they become independent, you know, completely independent, or maybe they need support for the rest of their lives, but we can help get there with them, you know.
I completely agree.
Yeah, that's what it should be. That's what it should be, you know. And it's like, I see so many keyboard warriors that are like, ABA is this and ABA is that and ABA, like, and it's
that
like,
never happened.
Like, but it did. And if something traumatic happened to you because of ABA, then we need to give those people the space to say something. Autism acceptance, you know, we just got off of Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month. We need to uplift everyone's voices that have been through traumatic ABA. Everyone's voices, not just the positive. Yeah.
One thing that always stood out to me is, and it made me realize that a lot of people that work in the ABA field don't know a lot about autism. And so when they're shocked that people who experience rumination, who experience intense feelings and emotions, are this upset and are fighting things with every tooth and nail that they have because they experience something so negative, but we're shocked of like, why would they say that? And how are they being able to say this about something that I love? And it's just like, autistic people are so powerful when it comes to what we express and what we feel. And so it's not surprising to me that these are the voices that are speaking out, and these are the people that are truly having a fight against ABA. And I don't blame them at all.
Exactly. Exactly. Because there is such thing as bad practices. There is such thing as bad BCBAs, bad BCABAs, RBTs. I still remember at one of my first supervisory jobs, I was asked to be the supervisor of a 3-sibling case. And there was one sibling in particular. And my clinical director at the time was like, are you sure you can handle this? I'm like, I can handle anything that you throw in my direction. And she was like, well, he engages in physical aggression and SIB 400 times a day. I'm like, okay. And the reason why he was engaging in that many, like, SIB and physical aggression is because they were putting him in CPI holds for saying verbal threats. That's bad ABA.
That's just truly mind-blowing. Like, I always say, especially with a discussion of holds and restraints, if someone was holding me down, I would want to beat everything out of you too. If someone was on top of me and holding me and restraining me, I would want to fight everyone too.
Yeah. And like, if you don't know CPI, some of the holds are ridiculous. I don't mean to talk bad about CPI, but like, there are some holds that just do not look safe. I know there's one in particular where it was like, there's two people on one person on one side, one person on the other side, and like their head is all the way down. And this was a hold that was described to me, and he was getting himself out of those holds because he didn't want to be touched. He didn't want those holds. And so when I started working with this particular child, I remember talking to his mom, and I remember her telling me about all these horror stories that happened within his ABA. And I took at it as, okay, like, I want to get to know this child first and foremost. And he did start to make verbal threats, but we didn't do anything because we knew that at that time, he just needed some alone time. And I think it took him maybe the first time he did this, I remember he took his stuffed animal, ran to his room, and the therapist and I, we stood outside the door, but we didn't want to go in there. We didn't want to, like, you know, run ourselves in there. He said he had a knife, and I was like, okay, you know, but it was really a fork. Yeah, maybe he did. Maybe he didn't.
Maybe.
Turns out he had a fork, and I was like, okay, you know, like, okay, whatever. Like, you know, it's clear that this kid needs a break. So the therapist and I, we were talking, and we started playing a game of Would You Rather. Less than 10 seconds later, he comes out, and he's right back into the session. Just goes to show you, maybe don't be a shitty BCBA and do CPI holds on a kid.
Some of the kids, we had a girl that if she even went to go swing at one of us, they were trying to get us to put her in a hold. And there was zero reason for it. And it just, And right now, we kind of, my at my clinic, are we're trying to like have the discussion of if we teach every therapist on what on how to use a hold, they're going to overuse it. And it's just what you learn, it's what just how you end up doing things. And we don't want that at all. And so it's baffling to know that that's some places that it's their immediate go to for every behavior that seems threatening to them.
Exactly, exactly. Like, you know, it, and the fact that there are still practices like this happening today is just baffling.
I just recently learned that a client of mine, her on her school bus going to school, that they would run drills and practice holds on her so that they would know what to do when she was escalated.
Are you kidding me?
And her mom told me this, and I said that would never even come to mind. Like, if she's just hitting me, we're good. We're working on de-escalation. You're not going to go and hold just because you're hitting me. I can handle that. And so to know that they were doing it to practice, to teach other staff, just in case she went into behavior that they were practicing on her.
Oh, my gosh.
I was nauseous when I found out. It's.
Oh, my gosh. Like, respectfully and disrespectfully, actually, I'm going to say disrespectfully, I would have beaten the shit out of those people.
Yes. Oh, and to know God. That these things are happening in other spaces and that it's accepted, it truly just leaves me speechless.
That's ridiculous, you know, and kind of knowing, like, you've had these conversations online, you've seen these conversations happen, and knowing all of your experiences, what did make you come back?
So when I was recruiting, I built a really awesome network on LinkedIn. Shout out to LinkedIn forever, because it changed my life. I was just continuously connecting with anyone and everyone that was engaging in the conversations that I liked. Like, I just wanted to hear more. And I built it to over 900, primarily people in ABA. And so I really saw the conversations that were going on in other places. I got to see some of the big advocates in our field that were speaking out against the same things that I believed, that were engaging in these conversations. And I saw that that's where so many other people wanted our field to go. I wasn't alone in that, where I felt so alone in so many of the other places that I had been in. And so seeing those conversations and really just being able to read it. My classmates in grad school made fun of me because I was scrolling LinkedIn like I was on Instagram every single day. I would be talking about a post I saw, an article I saw, like at all times. Like, I was such a LinkedIn advocate when it came to being in our field. And so that truly just lit the fire under me again, because it was really incredible to see all of the things being talked about in that time.
That's awesome. And, you know, I know personally going on LinkedIn and kind of seeing some of those conversations happen on there, I know personally, like, I've been able to get jobs because of LinkedIn, and some being good, some being not so good. But those conversations, the fact that they're happening, is super, super important too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you ever find a moment where, like, you ended up turning down any opportunities because they just didn't align with your values?
A lot of times. Once I truly found what I believed and what I was standing my ground, like, I had gone to the bad places, I had seen what I didn't want to be a part of, and so I kind of had more set standards and what that looked like. There are definitely places when I was looking for an RBT or a BCBA job, I was interviewing all over. I grew up in Florida, so I was going back in Florida and looking in different areas, North Carolina, Colorado. Like, I was looking everywhere. If I found a clinic that I felt safe at, that I felt like I could practice the way I wanted to, I was willing to move for it. And so there were definitely places that I interviewed. I interviewed at one clinic and I brought up ascent-based care and that I really wanted to learn more about it. And they were immediately, well, we don't practice that. And I was just like, okay, well, like, would I have the freedom to do it? And they were just fighting me on, well, if a child was standing in an ant pile, would you just let them? Like, you wouldn't just let them because that's not safe. We would physically have to remove them. And it was just, that's not what ascent-based care is. And so there was a lot of places that I had conversations with and I was just like, yeah, this isn't the place for me. And it was interesting to know, because there is such a demand for BCBAs. There are so many places that we can go and get a job tomorrow because they just want someone to bill for them. And I could have gotten a job so many places because there is such a demand. And so that was really important to me, to stand with my values and opportunities, because it didn't align with that.
Absolutely. I mean, it just kind of goes to show you that there are still ABA places out there that are, you know, trying to hide behind this beautiful facade, but then on the inside, you know, there's this like dumpster fire and this these like giant landmines kind of happening throughout too. You know?
It definitely, it's easy to put on the front of this is what we can show you that we are or anything, but when you're working at a clinic and you're burnt out, how you're still practicing says a lot about you. And so when you are in that burnt out space and being everything, like, you want a place that is going to support you and provide you with the tools that you need to get through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now you're in a different position. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah. So I work for Autism International Consulting in Spring, Texas. I work for Armando Bernal, and I met him at a conference last year, TexABA. I was still a student, and I went up to him after the conference, and I was looking for mentorship. And so I just went up to introduce myself, and he was like, oh, are you looking for a job? And I was like, I didn't want to move to Houston, to be honest. Like, that was just never something that I wanted to do. And yeah. So I was like, no, but yes, like, I'd be open to discussing it. And so about a week later, we met, like, talked about things, and I really liked the conversations that we were having. And so much similar, we had very different or similar experiences at some of the clinics that we had worked at. And so we just aligned really well. And so I drove out to Houston and did a shadow session one day. And I just felt that that was the place for me at the time. I'm still here. I started in August. And so it's been really cool to learn about that. A big part of it was that when I expressed the way that I viewed or saw things, there was no pushback. There was no like second looks at me. No one batted an eye of what I was saying. It was just, okay, do it. Like, if that's what you want to do, do it. And so it was just really cool to see like how the staff felt supported by him, and that there was no pushback for how I wanted to practice.
That's how it should be. That's exactly how it should be. You know, we should be coming in with the open mind of, you know, if you have a concern, say something. And if you feel something about something, let's talk about it and do something about it. You know, I remember being at actually the same job where the whole CPI hold situation was happening. And my first day, I remember hearing from an admin person, don't question what the BCBA puts in. I actually practice the opposite. And I say, question everything I do.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
You know, like, come on now. Like, if I'm doing something, you need to know why I'm doing it. It's not just like, hey, I'm going to add this program in here and then we'll call it a day. No. If there's a reason or if there's something that you need to know about this, please question me. Please practice philosophical doubt with me, because I really need that to challenge me just as much as it is to challenge you. So
we have to think in a way that is going to be effective for the therapist and going to be effective for the clients, and they're the ones implementing it. And I feel like when we're not taking those things into consideration, we're not making therapy realistic for the therapist or the kid. And so that is absolutely something that I practice as well, is like, if you want to know why we're doing this, I'll explain everything to you. Like, I will tell you my thought process and why we're doing these things. And if you have ideas, like, I'll explain to you why they may not work out, or I might implement them. It just really depends on what the conversation is. And that's one thing that I really, really enjoy about working at AIC, is that there's three of us. It's me, Armando, and another BCBA, Marie. And so we don't really ever always agree, but we're always willing to have the conversations and get each other's perspectives and hear each other out. It's not a my way and because I said so type place. And so that is something really that I needed. There's some days where I'm implementing something and I'll walk up to either one of them and I'm like, I already know the answer, but I just need the verbal validation. So this is what I'm doing. They'll smile at me and I'll walk away. Like, it's just nice to have those supportive people that I'm like, this is what I'm doing. Just tell me it's okay. And then I'll just walk away. And so it's really nice to just have people that believe in you and are willing to be those people for you.
That's huge. Employers out there, please listen to this, because I feel like our field can do better if we actually apply these types of practices. If we actually, you know, come from a place of being supportive and come from a place of not just like supporting, but listening, active listening at that, you know, please actually care about what we're saying, what we're doing, and how, you know, we want to help our clients. And if maybe our way, if what we're thinking, you know, if we need a little bit of guidance, give us that guidance, but do it in a way where we can be kind and empathetic to one another.
It is really awesome to be in a place that treats everyone like they're people, from the BCBAs, the owner, the families, the therapists, the kids. Like, everyone are people and we treat it as that. And it's not something that I can say about every place that I've worked. So it's really awesome to be in that space.
That's huge. That's huge. The fact that you can say that is definitely, it's crucial. And that's why we need more places like that. We need places to take that type of model, because at the end of the day, you know, if we can have at least a few ABA companies that could uphold those, maybe ABA wouldn't have such a negative stigma. However, because of all the other ones, that's why we're always going to have it. You know?
It is so baffling for me to hear when we have parents coming in and they say, oh, well, we weren't allowed past the front door when we were coming to pick up our kid. We weren't allowed to come in and bring cupcakes for the kids for them to drop it off. We weren't allowed to see anything outside of our child and outside of this front room. We weren't allowed to see their therapy or anything like that. And it is wild to me. And it's just kind of like, why can these kids, we joke when parents come pick their kids up early and we're like, no, you can't have your child. And it's just like, in what world would we sit here and tell you that you can't have access to your child or see what they're doing? It's as simple as sharing your kid's schedule with their parents so they get an idea. We are constantly sending pictures to parents and having those available for them, because it's difficult to trust your child, especially trust someone with your child, especially when they aren't able to communicate everything. And so being at a space that really, really values those experiences for the families as well is amazing to be a part of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you have a place like that, that will be willing to do that, especially too, you know, if the whole goal is for ABA, for us to, you know, get ourselves out of this job because we want to help our kids be able to live a least restrictive life and live their best life, we should be doing the sharing. We should be, you know, saying something. We should be sharing these stories. We should absolutely be doing these things.
It is all a big part of where we really want to go with everything in ABA. So it is nice to be in those spaces and to see that other people are doing the same things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things we also talked a little bit about a while back was your autism diagnosis. And, you know, how that was a major moment. So tell us a little bit about that and how that reshaped you to kind of see your past experiences too.
So I was someone who was diagnosed with essentially bipolar at the age of 14. I always knew that I had felt these very, very intense emotions all the time. And so I didn't get my autism diagnosis until I started grad school. It was a day I retook my RBT exam and I got kicked out of the exam because I was shaking so much because I was just so incredibly anxious. And it was just a day that made me feel safe in everything that I had been doing. It made me understand why I resonated with the kids that I worked at so much, why I was so passionate about everything that I was doing. It made me be more accepting to the kids, and more empathetic to everything that they were feeling. It was the push to give a kid a hug after they just get through with the tantrum, because it's hard to feel those emotions and to not have someone there to give you a hug. And it was just truly comforting to feel safe in myself and allow me to be able to teach the kids to feel safe in themselves. We have a kid that he's older, and I remember someone said something about autism and he was like, wait, I'm autistic. And we were like, yeah, but a couple of us are autistic. We're actually at a clinic that supports autistic kids. And so it was just like really cool to like share that with him. And I remember him just being like, huh? And so it's really nice to be able to share this experience and view everything from that lens. It's really awesome to be that the kind of view for a lot of our families and parents of like, I felt the same. I was blacking out when I was a kid and going into tantrums. Like, I resonate with your kid, and I know that these days are hard, and I know that all of these things are there, but like, we got to get the support for your kid because we don't want them to feel negative connotations with their emotions because they're feeling things so intensely right now and expressing this way. It's being the advocate for a lot of the kids that we work with. And so it was life-changing, as it is for everyone, but I am so, so thankful that I was able to get that, because I know not everyone is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I cannot agree more. Being an autistic BCBA myself, you know, I know that I've had conversations with families about, like, you know, I do kind of understand where you're at and kind of like how you're seeing your child, because that's how my mom saw me when I was younger. Or, you know, when it came to like certain tantrums or moments of sensory overload, like I knew what it was like. There were certain things that I couldn't relate to in that regard, but, you know, I've even like talked to some of my families about being autistic, and that's actually like helped them sort of, you know, be like, wow, the fact that someone who kind of does understand my child, it does make a difference.
I completely agree. I have a family, and I remember like at one point it was just kind of like, what are you doing? And because he was really responsive to me at times where he wasn't responsive to anyone else. And I was like, I am understanding and accepting and allowing this child to be who he is in every space and every, when that means I need him to feel safe with me so that this can be beneficial for him. Because if he doesn't, like we weren't seeing anything and he wasn't learning anything. And it's just like, we're just kind of taking your money at this point. Like, I know it's important to you guys, but we're not getting anywhere. And so I need this child to feel 100% safe with me so that we can get somewhere and I can teach him different ways to identify these things and be able to communicate what he needs to and when he needs help and when he needs space and when he's hungry and everything. And so it is amazing to be able to even think about those things, because sometimes when you've never felt those intense emotions or the switch when you're really hungry and why you're so angry and then you eat and it's just like, oh, that's all I needed. And so it's really, really awesome to be able to understand our kids in a lot of those ways.
Absolutely. I've been loving this conversation. Can I just say, like, you know, it refuels my passion so much.
Once people get me on this conversation, I don't stop. Like, everyone's like, when you're talking, it's just so passionate. I'm like, I love what I do. Like, I'm someone, I don't separate work from job because it's my life. Like, it's my everyday. Like, I'm driving, thinking about things and chatting, but it's not overwhelming because I love what I do. And so it's not somewhere people take work home and everything. Like, I love it. And so it is really awesome to be having these conversations and to be able to have the hard discussions about what we love as well.
Absolutely. When you love what you do and when you live for what you love, you know, it's hard to separate, but at the same time, it just means that you have so much passion in your heart and you just want to keep going for the sake of the clients you work with and for the community at large.
Everything just kind of makes sense. I've honestly been really, really incredibly lucky when it comes to my career, because I'm sitting here and saying everything that I've gone through out loud to know that these were my early experiences and the things that I went through. And truly, some of it didn't even touch the surface of a lot of the things that happened in those times. And so it's really mind-blowing to sit here and have these conversations and know that I still decided to come back and continue to be a part of everything. But even through everything, like, I got accepted into school in a really awesome situation. I was able to like live with family and have them support me during those times. And I got my job before I graduated from school at a place that I really, really loved. And so when everything works out, it's like, I'm exactly where I want to be. And I'm supposed to be a part of these conversations. And so it's hard to say that out loud, truly. Like, I remember sobbing uncontrollably when I sent you the message about having this discussion with you.
Yeah,
I was calling my best friend and I was like, I don't know why I feel like this. Like, I'm super excited, but I probably full blown anxiety attack, but I was so ready. Like, I knew that these things need to happen. And after everything that I've fought through and done it with everything, like, I can't stop now. I have to share these things because it's what I'm still here for. And I had to make those changes.
Keep disseminating, girl, because we really, really need more voices. You know, even the voices that are saying like, hey, this is shitty ABA. We need those voices because we need to do better for our population. We need to do better for the people that we serve, whether that be now, in the past, or in the future.
Throughout all of this time, I had the same therapist. He's incredible and has helped me through so much, but he was always, you're going to be a part of those conversations, whether you want to believe it or not, but I'm just going to sit here and wait until you get there. So like, we go through me leaving these clinics and he's like, yeah, like, you do those things. Or when he would tell me, like, you have to share these things because not everyone thinks the way that you do. And I would be like, yeah, there are. And he was like, you have been in so many spaces where not a single person saw things the way that you did because you experienced those things that of the kids are feeling in that moment or how you view things. And so he was always a part of that. And even remember when I started grad school and he was like, I told you were going to get here. You just had to take the time and do it on your time, but I knew you were going to get here. And so it was really awesome to feel someone believe in you that way. And he's always been a really big advocate for the place. So it's really cool to really see where it is now and being able to communicate all these things. Because I remember I'd go to him and I would just sob and I just didn't understand, and to communicate everything that's happened and have it be effective in those discussions.
Oh my goodness. I love that so much. That puts a big smile on my face.
Yeah, it's a great feeling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to go ahead and drop the second code word. It is resistance. That is R-E-S-I-S-T-A-N-C-E. That is the word resistance. So you've been a BCBA since February and you became a BCBA with the company that you're at. You actually finished your fieldwork hours with the same company.
Yes.
What kind of, I guess, like, what are your goals now and what kind of impact do you want to have in the field?
That's the question. I don't know what it looks like. I recently had a Finsta back in like high school and college. And at one point I had a post that said, I don't know what I want to do. I just know I want to make an impact on the world, and whatever that means, even if it's one person, like that's who I'm impacting and that's their world. And it was, I want to help support and have people graduate high school when they weren't supposed to, when people told them that they couldn't. And I want to be a part of people living their most authentic lives. And so I don't know what that looks like. I am very open to a lot of things. I moved 16 times growing up and in the last 26 years. So wherever life takes me, I'm open to grad school. If that's where everything takes me and I'm a part of the research side, if I'm going and have just continuing and having these discussions with people, I truly am open to whatever and wherever this takes me. I know I want to be in direct care for a while. I love it. Anytime they want to throw me on the schedule with a kid, please give it to me. I love direct care. So I do know I want to stay on that side for a little bit. But I don't know where this is going, but I'm really excited to see where everything goes.
I love that so, so much. I love that so much. And my final question is for others coming into ABA, especially those that are navigating harm or marginalization, what would you want them to know or have them carry with them?
As a new BCBA, one thing that I've really struggled with is knowing where to go to learn things that I want to learn in the way that I want to learn them. Is to not feeling like everything needs to happen at once. And in terms of knowing exactly what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and guys, I have such imposter syndrome, especially when it comes to parent support, that I'm like, I'm this 26-year-old girl who's trying to tell you what to do with your kids, and I know what I'm doing, but it is such a wild feeling sometimes. And so it is okay to feel all of those things, but it is one of the most valuable things to know that all of these people, all of these BCBAs who have been in the field for years, and all of the people who believe the same things that you believe, all are doing this to better the field. And it is 100% real to acknowledge that half of our field, or I don't know the percentages, but half of our field is within 5 years of being certified. And that a lot of these BCBAs who have been in the field are willing to have conversations with you. And it's not, don't be afraid to send the messages, to reach out to people. One of the most life-changing experiences that I have was WEBA last year. I loved it. I know you're getting to go this year. I love that conference. So I'm so excited for you to get an experience at Michelle. I met some really, really incredible BCBAs there, and it doesn't matter how long you've been in the field, your voice matters, and it's incredible valuable to be a part of the conversations. And so just don't ever forget that. Know that you can't always reach out to people, whether you might feel incredibly isolated in your world. There are always people that are willing to help and have been in your shoes and are wanting to help support you when it comes to progressing our field and disseminating everything. And so remember that. Don't, imposter syndrome is real, but don't let it overtake you.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's beautiful advice. Oh, Victoria, this has been an amazing conversation.
Thank you.
So happy. Of course. So where can our listeners find you?
So I am on LinkedIn as Victoria Contreras. I also just recently made an Instagram specifically for ABA. It's not your typical BCBA, kind of a take on neurotypical BCBA. And so I'm not really big into social media. Hopefully that changes. It's really just a way for me to follow the accounts that I want to without it overpowering my everyday Instagram. And I share a lot of the content that other people post to get the word across from different podcasts to conferences and different conversations that other people are sharing. So feel free to follow me on there. I love sharing other people's content, and eventually maybe I'll get to my own. But those are really the two places to find me. Or if you're ever in Houston, Texas, I'm always down to have these conversations. Grab a cup of coffee, grab some dinner, reach out, let me know.
Yes, I love it. I love it. Oh, thank you so much, Victoria. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will see you on the next one. Bye.
Bye.